Hello and welcome to Growth Coaching International's Coaching in Education podcast series. I'm your host, Richard Reid, and if you're a regular listener, you'll know that our focus over the last 20 episodes or so has been stories from the field. Educators from around the globe have shared both the challenges and the successes of incorporating coaching into their particular settings. However, for this episode, we're going to allocate time specifically to instructional coaching. Now, if you are an educator asking the question, what is instructional coaching? A good place to start would be to read through Jim Knight's latest book, The Definitive Guide to Instructional Coaching. In addition to this, in February 2022, our global director, Professor Christian Van Nieuwburg, produced a very helpful video interview with Jim discussing this book, and I'll include a link to this in our episode notes. Now, for this episode today, we intend to spend some time considering a few specific aspects within instructional coaching, where we feel it would be helpful for educators to gain some more clarity, and we have two extremely well qualified people to help us do that. Firstly, I'd like to welcome Dr. Jim Knight himself, senior partner of the Instructional Coaching Group based in Kansas in the US. Jim, it's a pleasure to welcome you to our podcast today.
Looking forward to the conversation. It's great to be here.
You're very welcome. And alongside Jim today, I'm equally delighted to welcome our own Executive Director, Chris Monroe. Chris, really looking forward to your input to the conversation.
Thanks, Richard. It's great to be here as well. Yeah, it's always a good conversation with Jim and yourself.
Good stuff. Okay, let's jump straight into it. Jim, you have a wealth of videos online that help explain instructional coaching. But there's one particular series of videos which focus on the partnership principles. And in the opening video, you introduced the topic as, and I quote, ideas that stand at the heart of what we do. Can you give us a bit of a flavor of the role the partnership principles play in instructional coaching?
Well, I just talked about this yesterday with Deb in Adelaide, so it's fresh in my mind, but I'm very conscious of the fact, unfortunately, that I'm getting old. You know, I'm 68, and who knows what the future holds? I suppose all of us have that. It's a really dark way to start the conversation. We're all going to die, and with times. But anyway, but I'm very conscious of the fact that I want the time I spend to be spent well. And a lot of the time we have is in conversations. And so I think it's really, really valuable to think about, well, what leads to a good conversation? And probably we're going to have a better conversation with someone who doesn't think they're better than us. And we're probably going to have a better conversation with someone who doesn't try to control us and who has our best interests at heart, who sees our strengths, who's open to our opinions and is shaped by those opinions. Who thinks they can learn from us. And in many ways, that's the partnership principles. We have words for those principles, but it's really about setting up a situation where two people of equal value interact in ways that lead to what Paulo Freire would call a mutually humanizing conversation, a conversation where you say you're better for having had the conversation. Hmm. And that's at the heart of it. And so, not every conversation is one where you look back and say, well, that was a good use of your time. But we would say, if you ground your conversations in those principles, more of your conversations will be ones where you say, man, that was time well spent. The flip side is also true. If someone tries to control us and tell us what to do and doesn't listen to us and thinks they're better than us and doesn't see our strengths, focuses on our weaknesses, and doesn't think they can learn anything from us, that's probably time that isn't well spent. It's probably not a good conversation. That's certainly not a person who can coach others and I think lead change.
Fantastic. Chris, any thoughts on the same question? You were nodding away there profusely.
Yeah, and Jim, this is where I started my journey in coaching, was the partnership principles back in 2011, 2010, I remember, Jim, and I asked you a question about it at the time. I was very nervous in a conference. I put my hand up and I said, those two principles that are jarring with me, Jim, voice and choice, ooh. And I remember saying to you, I've got a couple of colleagues just now that I think, ooh, choice might be dangerous and voice is one of the last things I want to give them more of. I was pretty honest at the time. I've seen the error of my ways since, Jim. But you had a very kind and humble answer for me rather than saying, what kind of person are you? And it was around freedom within form. I think since I've been doing the training and I've been running the Impact Cycle here in Australia for many years now, I remember us discussing this, Jim, and we said, look, nobody ever looks at the partnership principles, looks at the seven principles, those words, you know, equality, voice, choice. I'll start now and I won't be able to remember them all, but those seven words there, and says, oh, no, I don't think they're valid. I don't agree with those. I don't like that one. I'd change it. Everybody sits and nods politely and says, yeah, we subscribe to that. I've not met an educator yet that sits in the audience and goes, no, they're rubbish. You know, I want to just tell people what to do and do top down. But what we do is we start to unpack what they actually look like. And I think that's the key question for us, Jim, is that if you subscribe to those partnership principles, a good way to think about them is to think, well, what would they look like if I was living them out as a coach? If they were touchstones for me in my practice as a coach, what would they look like? And then the flip side of that is, how would others experience those principles if I was living them out? What would it feel like, look like, sound like on the other side? And we spend some time in the training doing that. But I think that's what brings it home for people, is partnership can be one of those, what Stephen Brookfield calls motherhood and apple pie terms, that you just throw it around like engagement, like everybody knows what it means. Because it sounds good, doesn't it? They're not going to say, no, I don't want a partnership. You know, but what does it actually mean in practice? What does it look like? And to say that's where the grounding is, and you've got the research background in that as well, Jim, from the original partnership study, it's been shown to be an approach that empowers educators, that results in change. And sometimes I think it can sound or is perceived as pick your own adventure, or a bit soft and fuzzy, and it's far from it. And we'll say more about the instructional coaching process here, obviously, but we don't want to say that, you know, this is just pick what you like, do what you like. I think dialogue is at the heart of it as well. And a meeting of those minds, as you describe it, John, Jim, in some of those videos, you know. So yeah, I think it's important for us to not just throw the word partnership around. It's to say, what would those principles look like? How would they be experienced? And that starts to bring it to life. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to add to that. one of the ways of living out the partnership principle of equality is not to interrupt, which I just did, but nonetheless, choice is when people get hung up on, but the reality is, like it or not, people have choice. You know, adults, even children, are really good at nodding their head yes and doing nothing. So the reality is the teacher has choice whether you want to acknowledge it or not. And pretending they're going to do what you tell them to do because they do it, you know, it's just not going to work, because they'll do it if they want to, they won't. They already have choice. They'll do the bare minimum. You really want committed people who roll up their sleeves and go for it. And you have to acknowledge that having an element of choice is important, because choice leads to commitment. You know, without people committing to it, it's not going to happen. And commitment is a choice. So I think choice on the surface, it sounds like, oh, you're going to let the teachers do whatever they want. Well, the teachers are going to do whatever they want. I mean, they might do some things, but if they don't care about what you're sharing, the least you can get is mediocre implementation, the bare minimum. What do I have to do to not get fired? I'll do that. You want commitment. You have to acknowledge the fact that professionals should have a choice anyway. They should have professional discretion. So to me, choice isn't soft. It isn't fuzzy. It's reality. And if you're not going to deal with reality and just pretend it's not there, you're probably not going to get the school you want. It's probably the way it's going to go.
Yeah.
Fantastic. That's genuinely very helpful, guys. And I like that idea. You know, when we think about the partnership principles, as coaches, as instructional coaches, good practice is self-reflection and asking ourselves that question, what would they look like if I was living them out? And asking colleagues, does it look like I'm living them out? The teachers that we're working with, does it look like I'm living them out? So that's a really useful question to pose to ourselves, I suppose, as coaches. Chris, if I could come to you for the next question. In a recent social media post, you touched on a very important aspect of instructional coaching, and that's the place of the expertise and knowledge of the instructional coach. You commented, and again, I quote, instructional coaches are not the fixers or fidelity police. The best instructional coaches partner with the teachers to make life easier as they strive to enhance student success and well-being in the face of complexity. I'd love you to unpack that one for us.
Yeah, I was quite pleased with that one. Just one of those moments where you've got, hang on, wants to distill what I was wrestling with or thinking about. And you know what social media does to you sometimes? You sit there going, argh, and I just thought, no, there's something here. And Jim, you know this is a recurring theme. I think it was a blog post on your Radical Learners blog a while ago now, and it was either Sharon Thomas or Michelle Harris that wrote it. Apologies to both of them if I got one wrong. And it was called Call Off the Fidelity Police. And it was a term that emerged in the States. And I recognize it here as well, that some of the approaches we see called, and some aspects of the approaches we see emerging that are being called instructional coaching, to me, start to look a little bit like that. And it was a reference there to, look, the work is complex. And the work of teaching and learning is complex, and you're immersed in the busyness of it. So there's two sides to it. The fidelity one is a tension between what we do know and what the instructional coach knows about the essential ingredients and how to share those dialogically of well-founded instructional practices. And I like well-founded as a phrase. What are we basing this on? It's not School of Bright Ideas, Pick Your Own Adventure, but there's those strategies are shared in a precise but provisional way, is the language we would use, Jim, that there's clarity and precision to the way the coach explains it, but it's not then enforced to the nth degree and you're drilling teachers to the point until they've got it right. To me, there's extremes here. One extreme end is pick your own adventure. What do you think? Let's try that on the kids. And that's probably not very ethical or helpful. And at the other extreme end is what I might call teaching for dummies. Some might object to that strongly, but some approaches to me from a distance look a bit like teaching for, or they could easily stray into, we don't know what to do. We just need to tell them if they could just do these practices exactly the way they're supposed to be done. And I just drill them until they've done it, then all will be right in education land. And I think we know it's more complex than that. And that isn't respecting the contextual knowledge and context of the actual teacher. And at its worst extreme, that could be a deprofessionalizing conversation and process. Even though you might get compliance, as Jim has alluded to there, that's not the goal, you know? And I think there's something we'll probably talk more about later. What helps there is the difference between a student-focused goal and a teacher-focused goal. We'll maybe say a bit more about that in a second. If the focus is on teacher practice, then you can drill people to fidelity and doing it right. But you might not be getting the impact in the students that you actually want. You might not be generating the learning that you want, but you're doing it. You're doing the practice. So there's a balance there. But the other aspect that we see sometimes is the way, and for me, this is fundamentally important because this was my early work in school, working with Jim's work, working with other coaching models and so on. How do I bring coaching and instructional coaching into a school as an integrated part of the professional learning architecture? That was a lovely phrase that one of my colleagues, Sophie Hunter, used in the school I was working with then. She said, how does this fit in the professional learning architecture of the school? How do you utilize instructional coaching as a part of the suite or at the heart of the suite? But it's not an add-on. It's how we talk about practice around here. It's how we improve around here. Now, there's resourcing questions around that, but part of that is, are we using instructional coaching as a treatment to fix people? And as soon as you start to get, and I know in some of the work we do, Jim, we talk about referrals from the principal and so on. As soon as you get conversations like, Chris, can you go and work with Richard? He needs some coaching. And that's coming from the principal or the head of department or something. And I'm going, oh, well, have you told them that they need coaching? Have you told them that there's an issue? Where are they getting that feedback from? When I'm being referred as a treatment for people who are perceived to be underperforming, then what you find is as you walk down the corridors as an instructional coach, all the other doors slam shut. And they say, no, you've got nothing for me. I don't need you. You work with the ones who are struggling, or you work with the beginning teachers. If we genuinely see this as a support service for all teachers, to look at their next personal best, to look at always getting better and being a professional, then you need to position that in a different way. So some of the language around there and some of the ways that it might be implemented with good intention can create that impression that this is about fixing people, this is about getting them to do it right, you know? So there's a tension there, and I think there are tensions. Tensions are things that we can mitigate. Tensions aren't things we can get rid of. But it's something when we implement instructional coaching, we need to be very aware of. And certainly, Jim, you talk in the success factors, you talk about leadership. And actually, one of the leadership things there is, how do you put this across? How do you position it within the school? Yeah. So I think there's something there that we need to be really aware of when we're implementing this. Yeah.
Jim, any thoughts on the fixers and fidelity police?
None at all. I have nothing to say. No, I'm sitting here just like exploding with ideas. One of them is let's put it this way. What does it mean to do it right? And to do it right is to have the maximum positive impact on the quality and the learning of children. Mm-hmm. Quality of children's experiences and learning. And I have seen, and I've worked at the University of Kansas, we have scripted materials that I used to share with people. I've watched people observe them with checklists, all about teaching with fidelity. You can do everything on the checklist, and the kids can be bored to spit. And so the solution is not to do it the way, the same way in every class, because every class is different.
Yeah.
And so we found almost always after you implement the strategy, you realize we have to make some modifications here. What is doing it right? Is it doing it right to do everything on the checklist? Or is it doing it right to make a difference in the complexity of the classroom? And when people talk about complexity, their example usually is, complexity scientists, parenting. Well, if raising one or two kids is complex, how complex is raising 30 or 35 in a classroom? It is the quintessential complex thing. And you know, people like Ron Heifetz say, the biggest mistake leaders can make is to take a technical solution and apply it to an adaptive situation, to have a recipe for something that's dynamic and crazy. And you have to adapt it. You have to modify it given the complexity of the work. And so, the reason why people like fidelity as a concept is because they like control. Organizations like control. Hmm. The boss is going to tell people what to do. And the only trouble is it takes the heart out of the art of teaching. Because what should happen is that kids should have better lives and kids should learn. And if you really want to reach the kids, it's probably not going to be one size fits all. It's probably going to be one size fits one. You're probably going to have to adapt it and make it work for the kids in their own individual place. Now, that doesn't mean it's okay to not have an impact on kids. Everything's driven by the change in students. And once you've got a goal and you're focusing on the change in students, I mean, sometimes I think people would prefer a strategy implemented according to all the items on the checklist as opposed to a strategy that transforms the lives of kids and helps kids who hated writing learn how to write and love how to write, as a group I just heard about the other day. So I think the key thing here is the focus should not be on the strategy. The focus should be on what are the changes we need to see in our children. And then you'll get the results you want to see, because there are a lot of strategies that are and often, if you add to it that the teacher doesn't actually really like the strategy very much, and then they're being told it has to be done according to a checklist. It's got to be done exactly this way. I'm going to follow up. I'm going to observe you. Even in the worst case scenario, your pay is going to be determined by how you do it. I mean, these kind of things. It's not surprising we're losing teachers left, right, and center, because they went there to make a difference in kids, and they're not going to make a difference in kids by doing everything just like everybody else. They have to respond to the individual needs of the kids. They have to adapt their own learning, and that's the power of coaching. Coaching is a structured activity, but it's adaptive. It's different for every teacher.
Yeah, no, that's very, very helpful. Links perfectly into the next question, Jim, and if I can address this one to you again, something that you'd stated on one of your videos: if you want to make a difference, one way to do that is to look at education. If you want to take that to the next level, it would be, how can I help teachers reach more children? How can I help teachers be even more effective? For me, Jim, there's a very definite focus on children here. We've touched on this already, and you've alluded to this already. How do instructional coaches manage the issue of student-focused goals versus teacher practice goals? So we talked about the strategy, can't use the same strategy all the time, but how do we look at that whole issue of teacher practice goals versus student-focused goals?
Yeah, here's what I would say about that. I'm loving this conversation. We've been doing this since the 90s. You know, I first started writing about coaching in 1996. That has given us a lot of time to make mistakes. And early on, we really didn't even have coaches. Just, you go out there and, you know, help them learn. We've got a body of effective practices to see if they want to do one, help them use it. And then we sort of amped up the focus on the teaching practice. And what we found was, and so we had whole systems where we were training them on evidence-based practices that were, a thing called content enhancement, which is really powerful for, diverse classrooms. And teachers liked it. They just didn't do it because the focus was on the strategy. The focus wasn't on the students. Hmm. And we learned, it took us about 10 years to figure this out. And this is going to sound arrogant. And I'm actually writing a paper about humility right now. So
it's probably
ironic that I'm saying this. But I hear people talking about coaching, and I think they're like 15 years behind where we are. They're saying the focus is on the teaching practice. They have to do the teaching practices. And what we found is if you focus on the practice, it doesn't get sustained. They don't stick with it. And it doesn't change what happens for kids, not in the long way, not in the long run, especially, like I said, if they don't care about it. Yeah. So we believe you have to start with a change in students. And we focus on, I'm not going to get into all the details, but we focus on engagement and achievement. And we talk about behavioral engagement, cognitive engagement, emotional engagement. And then we talk about a whole bunch of things about how to measure achievement. One of the things that would be, what kind of learning do we want to see? Is it acquisition? Is it connection? Is it transfer? And you're going to assess those things differently. And so when the teacher says, you know what I really want is I want my students to take these ideas about writing and use it in their writing in their other classes, that's going to be a different kind of assessment than if you're just doing to see, did they acquire the knowledge and can they repeat it? So your assessments are going to be grounded in that. And what we do is usually when the teacher comes to you, they have something in mind they want to work on. They say, oh, I really want to work on small group activities, or I want to integrate more technology, or I want to ask a different kind of question. So we say, well, if you ask a different kind of question, what's going to be different for the students? And then that expertise that the coach has that Chris talks about, then the coach is able to say, if the teacher says, well, I'd like this, but I'm not really sure what it is, the coach can say, is it all right if I share some options of ways you could measure the goal? And if any of them sound what you want, we can go with that, or I can go do ChatGPT and come back with some more next week. You know, so the coach helps them set a student-focused goal, and there's a set of questions we ask, there's a process we follow that almost always lands on a student-focused goal. Now, you still may modify the goal. You might say, I don't have the right measure, or this was too conservative or too ambitious, or you might want to take some modifications along the way. But the whole, and ultimately, if you want to go back to the people who make decisions about your school and say, is coaching working or not, you need to be able to say, here are the goals we set for students. Here are the outcomes we got. What's going to make, if you really want to be precise about the change is what changes do we actually see in the quality of kids' lives and in the learning of students? And without a student-focused goal, if you just focus on a strategy, it's kind of like, well, I think it probably worked. It's like it's very, very fuzzy. And when you're talking about resources in a system, you need to be able to precisely say, this is what we did, this is what we got. And having a student-focused goal helps you do that.
Chris, any thoughts?
Great response. Yeah, and I think to use an old chestnut example, Jim, what you just described there as a measure of success is very different from, oh yeah, it's working because everyone's using learning intentions and success criteria. You know, I see them on the board every day, and you want to say, well, and so, you know, what difference is that? That's not the measure of success. You know, it's back to that fidelity issue again. I think, Jim, just as a devil's advocate thing here, and I'd be interested in your response here, putting you in the spot. You and I know, and we're very aware, you know, and we're not anti this at all, that the evidence-based scientific kind of language that's emerging around instructional practices just now, evidence-based everything, and research-informed and evidence-based, whatever, which phrase we're using today, I don't know, which is why I always say well-founded. It's not that we don't know anything. It's not that this is a black art and you just do what you think, you know. And so, you know, the phrase that I think is Dylan Williams attributed to, of lethal mutation, that sometimes certain practices have key ingredients, key steps, key ways of that, things that make it work. And if you allow that to be adapted and shaped and reshaped too much, you end up with a lethal mutation. And that's when you get teachers say, oh, that didn't work in my class. And it might be because it wasn't the same strategy. They think they were doing the same strategy, but they weren't, that was in the research or in the evidence. How do we respond to that, Jim? Because it will be something that this, when people listen to this, that might be a point that jars with them a little bit.
Well, let's say I'm working with a teacher. I'm doing Fisher and Fry's gradual release model. The I do it, we do it, you do it.
Yep.
And the teacher wants the kids to be able to identify main ideas in their paragraphs. And that's their assessment. It's part of their reading assessment. But right now, if the kids can find the main idea in the paragraph and paraphrase it, that'd be awesome. That's what I want to see. That's the goal. And they figured out how they're going to measure it in partnership with the coach, and they've got a really clear measure. So they know what they want. I want at least when the kids read, I want at least 80% of the time when they read a paragraph, they can find the main idea of the details. I'm not saying that's a great goal, but that's the one the teacher wants, and it's a part of the assessment for students. That's what she wants. And she says, you know, I'd like to do this gradual release thing, but I don't want to do it the way it is in the book. What I'd like to do, you know, the gradual release, it's that I do it, we do it, you do it. I think I just like to do the you do it. Is that okay? Can I do the you do it? And that would be, I guess you'd call it a lethal mutation. If I was the coach, I would say, well, I think the thinking behind this is that students need to see it done well, and then they have to practice. They have to practice to see how in an easy way, and then they have to apply it. That's the you do it, and that's why it's designed that way. But we have a goal. If you want to try it your way, let's try it. If it hits the goal, great. If not, we'll come back and we'll change it. Because the thing is, the teacher is going to do what they're going to do anyway. Yeah. I mean, you can tell them it has to be done this way. When you leave, they're going to say, I'm just going to do you do it. So I think what leads to change, or what leads to high quality implementation, is the goal. Because she's not going to hit the goal, or he's not going to hit the goal unless he does it effectively.
Yeah.
It might not look exactly the way it is in the book, but you're not going to get the outcomes you want with it, or maybe you will, but most likely you won't. So I would say that that I'm not too concerned about the lethal mutations. I think when you recognize upfront, this teacher is going to do what they're going to do regardless of what I say, and stop trying to control them, then you're going to have a conversation where you say, well, here's the arguments for it. Now, every kid's different. Every teacher's different. We have a goal. How do you want to try it? It's up to you. When you put them in control, then you get a deeper level of implementation, and you get the outcome you want, which is high quality implementation, because you have a goal. The goal is an objective standard for excellence. It's not up to me to tell them what to do. The goal holds people true. Yeah. And so that's kind of how I see it. And we believe you should look at the evidence. You know, I've written a paper for John Hattie about instructional coaching and how it applies to visible learning. And I'm working with Brian Goodwin on a lot of work around his work around classroom instruction that works, sort of the new Marzano. They took Marzano's work at McRell and revised it. So I'm all about, and I worked at a research center for more than 2 decades. I like research-based material, but what really matters is local validity.
Yeah.
Is it working with these students in this class? Because some of those studies that have high effect sizes or that meet the criteria of what works clearinghouse, they were done with a certain clientele that doesn't necessarily reflect your students. And it doesn't generalize to every classroom. So you can trot out your numbers, but what really matters is, did the quality of kids' lives improve? Did the kids learn more than they would have if they hadn't used it? And if we use this strategy in the way that's most effective for this particular teacher and this particular group of students, that's what I call local validity, not external validity. So that's my take.
I managed to get you wound up with that provocation there. That's brilliant. I think you're right.
I wound up the whole conversation.
I think it's we know stuff, don't we? We do. And for me, what you've just described is what each party brings to the table. If this is a dialogue, then it's a meeting of the minds. And there's things that you bring as an instructional coach. You bring that research background. You bring the understanding. And it's not that at that next conversation you say, oh, well, sorry, Richard, I didn't think it was going to work. I thought it was going to be a train wreck. But hey, I wanted you to try. You know, it's actually say, well, okay, let's look at why it might not have worked the way you thought it would. You've tried it. There's an iteration. It's a cycle. It's not a one-off conversation to get you to do it right. It's a cycle of iterations to try and hit that student outcome, student goal that you want to see in your classroom. And I bring a whole load of expertise and knowledge. And I'm actually a broker of things that I don't know or not expert in myself. I'm actually a resource for you in this conversation. But we're both looking at that evidence together, and we're adapting and iterating it to suit your context. So it's a highly contextually respectful approach to using evidence, if you want to use that phrase. And again, I'm not here to endorse Dylan William over and over again, but I really like Dylan's, it was a long time ago, he said, look, just what you said there, Jim, in an elegantly simple way, research tells you what worked then in that context. And it gives you some signposts to what might work for you now, rather than this will work for you. There's always a provisional nature to that as well. But I think that's part of what that thinking and that dialogue is a big part of what the instructional coach supports for the teacher, because they don't have the time and the headspace to do that themselves.
Yeah, but the other thing about this is I really believe in research, and John Hanny I consider a good friend, and I hope to see him when I'm in Australia. He's living on the Gold Coast now, I think. So I'm going to hunt him down. And I worked with people, and we had researchers come in and out of the research center who were highly esteemed, globally recognized researchers. But the thing is, they don't agree. So, Hattie's looked at millions of studies, and he calculates the effect size for these studies. But other people will say, well, I don't agree with that using effect size as the measure. I think you should use this way of looking at it. And then you'll have studies of cooperative learning where one has an effect size of 0.75 and another one has an effect size of 0.3 and the average effect size. So do we go by the 0.75 effect size or do we go by the 0.3? So it's not conclusive. It's not like you can go online and get a list of these are the 15 things that everybody agrees on you have to do. It's not like we've got a pill and we've proven it. It's not like that. It's there's great controversy. You go to the International Reading Association conferences a few years ago, it was like bringing together two polarized groups because there was such a difference of opinion about how instruction should take place. There's strong opinions. So to me, the important thing is you look at that research. Now, if you look at it, there's some things that I think it'd be pretty hard to say having a teacher understand what they're going to teach and clearly communicating to the students what the outcomes are they want, what John would call success criteria. Pretty hard to say feedback's not a good thing. And you know, many of his core things I think are absolutely essential in any classroom. He's done a great service to us to focus us on some things. But I think Brian Goodwin has done much the same thing with classroom instruction that works. So you start there, but then the question, because every time we do the impact cycle, when we get to the improved stage, which is the adaptive stage, it has to be changed. Yeah. It never works the way it is in the book. It has to be modified to make it work. So that's how I see all this. And of course, evidence is important, but it's not the evidence about teaching practices is not the same as, well, I mean, in healthcare, there's lots of controversy about how much you should do with your health too. But I think the proof is in, did it have an unmistakably positive impact on the quality and the learning of kids' lives.
Fantastic. Chris, you mentioned when you were responding there, the word cycle. Jim, you mentioned the word impact. I'm going to put those two words together and ask you, Chris, the next question. One word that is genuinely synonymous with instructional coaching in both the research and the training is impact. So if I wanted to train as an instructional coach, tell me a bit more, Chris, about the impact cycle.
Yeah, and I'm very self-conscious doing this with Jim listening, so he can give me a score at the end and tell me if I get the answer right. But I've been doing it long enough that I think I know what I'm talking about now. But the impact cycle, it's funny. People
give you
see
a scale of 1 to 10.
I say, okay, thank you. Do it secretly afterwards. I prefer feedback privately, not publicly. Thanks. I think the impact cycle is a name of a training program that we do. It's a name of one of Jim's seminal texts. And I often describe when I stand there and I hold up the book, I say, look, this is probably one of the most valid research-informed and evidence-based models you could find, because it has been those iterations of 20 years from the original partnership study. And I know all the work that you've done, Jim, over the years with your team in terms of seeing how it plays out and refining to that. And it's part of, it's one of those seven success factors. So that cycle, I often have to add the words instructional coaching on the end of it, because people see the impact cycle and they go, what's that? It's an instructional coaching cycle. And the way I sometimes sum it up is it provides the how of instructional coaching cycles, but it's grounded in the why and the what. A lot of approaches we see, or some other approaches we see, start with the what. They start with all the instruction. They start with the things we want people to be able to do, and are maybe sometimes sketchy, sometimes, you know, in different directions. You've alluded to, Jim, there's different models all over the place. But what the impact cycle does is it provides what's effectively an improvement cycle. And I'm going to use your phrase, Jim, which I borrow regularly. It looks elegantly simple. I remember looking at illustrations with you, Jim, at one point. You said it has to look elegantly simple. Sometimes the impact cycle can look deceptively simple. And if you've looked at school improvement models elsewhere, Helen Timperley's teacher inquiry cycle and so on, there's lots of similarities, no surprise there. But what's important is that you understand what's underneath each of those little bubbles on the nice diagram. You know, so Jim pointed out some of the phases there. So in brief, one important thing we need to say is all of this is grounded in partnership. And it's grounded in an understanding of both the complexities of adult learning and change and the well-founded instructional practices. So that's where we start grounding it in those terms. Then, because there's a danger, you just pick up the cycle and you go, okay, these are the steps I go through and I just do it to people. You know, it's not just a process. And, you know, often people get instructional coaching roles or they end up in these roles because they know their stuff in terms of instruction. But less attention is paid to that critical importance of how they show up and how they manage the dialogue and the process of improvement. And that's really what the impact cycle brings a shape to and gives you the how of. So very briefly, this is where Jim will be assessing me now. The identify phase is where we start. And that's basically saying, so what's the teacher's current reality? And really what we're doing there is what I like to call goal seeking. It's goal seeking data we're looking for. And we would advocate, and we could spend a whole session just talking about video here, Jim. We're not going to do that. But it's what are we seeing in the students and what do we want to see more of? Not is this practice in place or not. It's what we see in the students, what we want to see more of. And video is the most powerful tool here. There are other sources of information. You could use observation. You can use student work samples. You can interview students. But we need to actually think about what's the best form of data to show us what it currently looks like when I do what I do. And that's grounded in one of those complexities that most of us don't know what it looks like when we do what we do. And I'd even go as far as saying, the more competent you are as a teacher, the more adaptive and responsive you are, the harder it is in the moment to see what it looks like when you're doing what you're doing. So it's very much not for struggling teachers. And when I say we, I mean actually the coach and coachee together. So there's a dialogue there where it isn't just the coach telling the coachee what they see and what they think they need to do and where they should start. It's not that at all. It's actually both of us looking at this third point of reference together, looking at what's happening in depth, looking at comparing that with what we would expect to see, having some kind of points of reference there. And then the coach using skillful questioning and that range of data, a goal emerges in that dialogue. A goal area or a focus area emerges. We narrow that down. We describe what that would look like. So we've got reality. We've got a goal starting to pop out. The goal, as Jim has said, is what we would want to see more of in the students. And then in the process of doing that, we end up starting to identify a pathway to that goal, a first couple of steps to that goal. And depending on how far away they are just now, that might be a series of strategies, but we need somewhere to start. And that's where some of the coach's expertise might come to the table, might. But as Jim said, you know, there's often a hunch. I think I probably need to work on my questioning. Or I remember that PD we did and we talked about this. I've never quite got that to work in my class. You know, Jim, there's a little video we use in the program where we show a teacher who is kind of frustrated, very brief video where she's frustrated because our warm-up activities never seem to go well. And you had timed it and it took 27 minutes. And it's non-inferential, non-judgmental data. It just took 27 minutes. And that could have been, really? Warm-up activity? 27 minutes? What are you thinking? It wasn't that. It was just, look, I timed it. It's 27 minutes. How does that look? You know, what were you hoping for? And in that little commentary that teacher gives, you see that it could be about the warm-up activity. It could be about planning. It could be about understanding where our kids are at in their learning. It could be about the design of the activity. There's a whole range of places she could start to get that. But it's not about the warm-up. It's actually about what she wants to be generating from that. So that identification of a goal and a way forward is where we're at there. Then the learning phase is, well, what do I need to get better at, learn about, learn more about, in partnership with the coach to help me do that in my next lesson or in the class. And that might mean then that you need some of me, you need some modeling. And I will say modeling is a highly nuanced, very specific aspect of helping here and of the learning phase. It's not just monkey see, monkey do, watch me, rehearse it till you've got it, let's go and do it. It can be in the class, it can be out of the class, it can be using other people. There's a whole range of ways of doing modeling effectively, and there's pros and cons of them all that we explore when we do the training. So that learn phase is you partnering with the teacher to help them really get their head around what they want to be trying next. And then they're set up to go off and have a go at it on their own two feet in their class. And this is where the cycle bit kicks in. Jim mentioned a minute ago the improve part. So the improve phase then is, okay, they're off and running. They're trying this new approach in their classroom context. And we know that 9 times out of 10, it doesn't work perfectly first time. They don't hit it exactly. How can the coach then help? So it's about maintaining momentum towards the goal. So the coach supports the reflection of the coachee. Sorry, this is becoming a long answer, Richard. But what they're doing is helping them then provide a lens. They start to help them identify evidence of impact. They start to be a data collector in different ways. They have a conversation about what are we noticing? What do we want to see more of? What might we need to adapt? Is there a new strategy we want to add? That one seems to be making the difference. What's next? So what it becomes in the improve phase is an iterative cycle of identifying, learning, applying, adapting, reapplying, identifying, learning, and so on until the goal is hit. Jim, I remember a while ago you described it as relentless pursuit of the goal. But each time we're checking in, is that still the right goal? Because sometimes that shifts in the reality of it as well. So there's a cycle there. I think that's the cycle word is often overlooked. It's not one shot, right, you've got it. Now let's move on to the next step. It's actually the goal is at the heart of this as well. So those three phases, identify, learn, and improve phases, form that improvement cycle over time. Yeah. How did I go, Jim, with that big, long explanation?
I think it was great. What was your phrase?
You said this to me. See, it's always lovely when I quote someone back to them and they don't remember it was their phrase. Elegantly simple was the phrase, because I was showing you a diagram I had developed and you went, oh, I think it should be elegantly simple.
Well, thank you for that comment, because it is our goal is to come up with things that are easy and powerful. Mm. And we use Apple as our model, you know, the iPhone. You have the universe at your fingertips and a four-year-old can use it. Now you add the ChatGPT app. Goodness, what is on that phone? It's amazing what you can accomplish. You can probably check into the Bodleian Library and see original images of Shakespeare's, whatever you want. You know, you can see it. And a kid can use it. You know, so that's powerful and easy. And that's what we're striving for. And I'll just say briefly, the research we used was an approach called lean design research. And it was sort of taking a basic design model. And I was really influenced by a book called The Lean Startup, about which is usually used with technology. And so in the back of the book, we describe the research process. But what we do is we start with a goal and then we implement and we see how we did. And then we figure out something that's not working very well. And then we look at the literature, we interview experts, we problem solve on our own or some combination of those things. And then we do another circle, making a change in the cycle, and then we repeat it. And so through that process, we learned about the power of checklists. We learned about the power of goals. And then we came up with our own. We looked at the literature on goals. We came up with what we call peers goals. We modified a lot of the model and we went from an 8-stage sort of linear process to the 3 steps of the impact cycle. At one point, it was kind of a 5. It wasn't even a cycle initially. And so in working directly with the coaches, who they would try it out, they would give us feedback, and we would identify friction, then collaboratively would come up with the next step. That's how we created the impact cycle. And then we measured it for impact. And the effect size was 1.03 on student engagement. It's a pretty high effect size. Now, it was a small sample. More studies need to be done, but clearly worked. And the process was one that was grounded in, the coaches were partners in the whole process. It was a learning process collectively, but it took us 11 iterations to land on what ended up in the impact cycle, and we're still learning.
Chris, can you share with us a bit about the upcoming Instructional Coaching Institute in Australia and also the impact cycle training coming up to the UK?
We've got a very busy and exciting few months coming up, Jim and I. So first up, on the 18th to 22nd of September, not far away now, Jim, in less than 4 weeks, around 4 weeks. Jim is going to be in Australia for the first time in 3 years. I don't quite think it's quite your adopted home, but you're getting close to that, Jim. I think you're more Aussie than I am sometimes. But Jim is bringing his Instructional Coaching Institute, so a 5-day intensive experience. I'll be there, Jim will be there, a few of our consultants will be there, and educators from all over Australia coming to that at the Victorian Academy for Teaching and School Leadership here in Melbourne, to really dig deep into all those things that you flagged there through this conversation, Jim, you know, all those success factors of instructional coaching. So it's probably one of the deepest and most intense learning experiences you can get in this kind of space. And it's, you know, been going a long time in the States there. So that's the first thing. Really excited about that. And then in October, I'm heading in the other direction. I'm coming to London to work with you, Richard. And we're going to be launching the Impact Cycle, the first time the Impact Cycle instructional coaching training has been run in the UK on the 12th and 13th of October. So I'm coming there on my way to Orlando to join Jim for the Teaching, Learning and Coaching Conference on the 16th to 18th of October, where what do we describe it as, Jim? It's like Woodstock for instructional coaches. It's the biggest event in the world for instructional coaches, this time in Orlando. So I'm really, really excited and really fortunate to be coming and joining Jim and a whole load of other exciting people there as well. So yeah, it's going to be a busy couple of months. Yeah. So there'll be lots more about those events. There's some things going out in social media and advertising around that just now, but yeah, make a note of those dates. Mm. Yeah.
Jim, what are your hopes and aspirations for all of these developments between the two organizations?
Well, first off, one thing I want to make clear is that it's the Instructional Coaching Group, ICG, and it's Growth Coaching International, which is GCI. And of course, Australians always tell me that everything's backwards in North America. So we've just taken GCI and done it backwards. So there's that going on. It's ICG and GCI. But the Institute will, I think, if you're interested in what's it take to lead change, and it has life skills appropriate or learning that takes place too, because it's really about a big part of it is how you communicate. It probably should affect your life as much as that. And it's a community of people grow together. They learn about these things we've talked about and how to put them in play. That's what that's about. There's growing interest in instructional coaching in the United Kingdom, and so I'm thrilled that Chris is going to be there. And then the Teaching, Learning, Coaching Conference is, it is really amazing. We have about, I think, over 30 presenters. Probably collectively, they've written more than 200 books about coaching, and just an amazing group of people. Six keynoters. Christian Van Neuerberg is one of the keynoters. Chris is going to be one of the presenters, but many people well-known in the United Kingdom and also across Canada and the United States who are experts on coaching. And the thing I want to clarify is that it's also virtual. So you can, if you're in Tasmania, you can watch the conference, and it's on for, I don't know how long, at least 90 days. You can, and that means you don't have to miss any breakout presentations. You can see everything. So if people are interested, I started it 16, 17 years ago, and my goal was just to bring together people I wanted to learn from. And it's just snowballed. Now we're going to have probably over 2,000 people when you combine the virtual and the maybe 2,500 or more, depending on how effective this podcast is and getting people to go to it. So, but it's a lot of people, and it's really, the truth is coaches are the best people. I mean, they are the best audience because they made a moral decision to become a coach. And if they've been coaching for a while, they realize they have to be effective communicators, or either they learn how to communicate or they come in with those skills. Mm-hmm. So when you bring them together, they're excited about learning. They communicate well. They're just awesome to do workshops with coaches. I love it. And this is like 1,500 in the same room. It's going to be pretty cool.
I love to be able to conclude the episode being able to compliment all the coaches around the globe, particularly those folks who are listening in. Jim and Chris, thank you so much for your input to this conversation today. It will certainly serve to provide that much needed clarity out there around those specific aspects of instructional coaching. There are certainly exciting times ahead for educators as we hear about the programme of courses in the pipeline from both Growth Coaching International and the Instructional Coaching Group. For our listeners, please do check out the websites of both organisations, where you can access a wealth of material as well as schedules for upcoming courses and much, much more. I'll include links for these in the episode notes. And in the meantime, I trust you will all join me on the next episode of the Coaching in Education podcast series.